we're down to the final chapter, which is a chapter called The Chromosomal Basis of Inheritance. We're paying attention more to what happens at the chromosome level in this chapter than we have in other chapters. But the opening slide features a cross that we've already talked about. This is a dihybrid cross. What is it that makes it dihybrid? Or any dihybrid cross, what makes it dihybrid?
There's two.
Not enough information.
Is it dihybrid?
Yes.
It's from the mother and the father. One mother and the father is both giving their genes.
That's what makes it a cross. In any cross, there is a mother and a father giving genes. Right. In a dihybrid cross, two characteristics are simultaneously being tracked. What is the hybrid aspect of dihybrid? No. Each parent has both characteristics.
Two traits?
There are two traits for each characteristic, but one parent has one trait and the other has the other trait. In a dihybrid, that's true for both characteristics. So notice that the one, what are the characteristics here, first of all? Seed texture is one. Seed color is another. Yeah. So notice that one parent is yellow and round. Yellow is different from green. Round is different from wrinkled. The other parent is green instead of yellow and wrinkled instead of round. Okay? But the fact that you're simultaneously paying attention to color and texture makes it a dihybrid cross. Nothing new about that. We've already talked about that the first time we looked at this cross. Notice that next to each parent is a genotype. Upper, upper Y, upper, upper R for one. Lower, lower Y, lower, lower R for the other parent. Why does each of those genotypes feature two Ys and two Rs? No. The fact that there's a Y and an R means that there are two characteristics. There's a Y gene and a Y and an R gene. Those correspond to the two characteristics. Genes correspond to characteristics. My question is, why are there two Ys and two Rs in each of the two genotypes, one for each parent?
Diploid.
Yes, because they are diploid individuals, right? So they have two Y alleles for the Y gene, since they have two chromosomes, each carrying a Y allele, and they have similarly for the R gene, right? So when you look at those, when you look at the pictures, you can tell that phenotypically one is yellow and round and one is green and wrinkled. But when you look at the genotypes, you can more specifically tell that they are both true breeding for both of these characteristics, right? The yellow round one is double homozygous dominant. Homozygous dominant for color and for texture. The other one is double homozygous recessive. Okay, now we've looked at all of that before, but what's shown here that hasn't been shown before is pictures of chromosomes. So you can see a cell, cartoon cell, corresponding to each parent. Now, what is the N that's indicated here? No. I admit that's kind of a trick question. I don't actually know what the N is. But the point here is that however many types of chromosomes pea plants have, we don't care about all of the other chromosomes. All we care about are the chromosomes that carry the genes for the characteristics that we care about in this cross. Remember, you're in a dihybrid cross, you care about exactly two characteristics, no more. So you don't care anything about their flower colors if they grow up to be plants or anything like that. All you care about are these two characteristics. Well, those are governed by two genes. Characteristics correspond to genes, remember. And so the color gene, seed color gene, is on one chromosome. The seed texture gene, the R gene, is on a different chromosome. And that's why we have to pay attention to two chromosome types, but that's all. We don't care at all about all the rest of the chromosomes. All right? And there's four overall chromosomes in each parent because they're diploid. So there's two chromosomes carrying the Y gene, there's two chromosomes carrying the R gene. The black marks on each chromosome, or the black mark on each chromosome, represents what? The allele in question, yeah. We also, not only do we not care about all the other chromosomes, we also, on each of these two chromosomes, don't care at all about all the other genes that they're carrying, right? Only the genes that we care about for this cross. And so the black, yes, it represents the allele, and where that black is represents the locus of that gene on that chromosome. Okay, now for each of these two parents, notice that below it, there is a gamete. Why does each parent have only one gamete listed?
That's all they can make.
Why?
Because if they have the Y and the R.
What genetic description of them explains it in one word? They're not both dominant. One parent is recessive. That describes the overall cross. I'm saying what description, genetic description of each parent explains why that is the only possibility for the gamete.
Double homozygous.
Yes, they're true breeding, in other words, homozygous. Since they're homozygous, when it comes time for meiosis, which produces their gamete, to randomly choose one of the two chromosomes, it doesn't matter which one gets chosen, right? Doesn't matter which one of the capital Ys you choose, you're going to get a capital Y. Doesn't matter which capital R you're going to choose, it's going to be a capital R. So this parent can make only one kind of gamete when all you care about are these two characteristics. The other parent, similarly, only you're going to definitely get a small Y and a small R. Okay? That's why one gamete exactly is shown for each parent. Since each parent can make only one kind of gamete, considering only these characteristics, then there's only one possible zygote that can be formed when these two gametes fuse in fertilization. Right, that's going to get you back to diploid. The gametes were haploid. But when you allow them to fuse in fertilization, you get back to the diploid stage. And since one gamete has a capital R, the other gamete has a lowercase r, and similarly for the Ys, that means the only possible genotype for every zygote is going to be upper lower Y, upper lower R. Which explains why phenotypically every one of the F1 generations will look alike. They'll all be double dominant. They'll dominant with respect to color, dominant with respect to texture. So they will look just like one of the parents, the yellow round parent, but they won't be genetically the same, right? every one of the F1s will be double heterozygous. And just because of dominance, they'll have the dominant trait for each of these two characteristics. But the yellow round parent was double homozygous. Right? Okay. So now we can see that in their cells, all of the F1s have one red version and one blue version for the R-carrying chromosome and for the Y-carrying chromosome. Okay. Now, as usual, we cross two F1s to produce the F2 generation. But this brings up these two text boxes that are conspicuous on this slide. Two laws that Mendel himself came up with, without, of course, knowing anything about chromosomes. But they are the law of segregation and the law of independent assortment. Law of independent assortment, we've already really talked about. I didn't tell you it was the law of independent assortment, but we've already defined independent assortment. Law of segregation, we'll talk about in a minute. Both of these laws describe things that are happening in meiosis, and more specifically, meiosis one. Now, independent assortment should be reviewed. What is assortment just by itself? Almost. What lines up?
Homologs
don't line up in metaphase one.
Where is they replicated?
Replicated chromosomes don't line up in metaphase one. They line up in mitosis.
Oh, I remember the drawing.
What is it that lines up in metaphase one? Tetrads. Pairs of replicated chromosomes, homologous pairs. Okay, so back to my original question. What is assortment? The fact that there's 1 week left to know all of this stuff, right? And that this last test is can make the difference between failing or passing? Okay. So you're going to spend a whole week reviewing this? Assortment is the way in which a tetrad lines up during metaphase one. Why are there two possible ways of lining up for a tetrad? But why does that matter? What do you mean by either position?
Like, one can be on the top, one can be on the bottom.
One what?
Two red tetrads on top, or one red, one blue.
No, there's no such thing as a red tetrad or a blue tetrad. A tetrad is red and blue together. Right? That's what makes it a tetrad. There's two of the same kind of chromosomes. They're homologous, but they're not identical. If they were identical, then it wouldn't matter which way they line up. But since the blue is not the same as the red, other than they're the same type of chromosome, how they line up is going to determine which cell gets one and which cell gets the other.
Then they can be identical.
Well, if they were identical, then assortment wouldn't matter. But they're not identical because one of those homologs came from one parent and the other one came from the other parent. All right? So they could be identical for one gene that you care about, yes. But that's what assortment is. Independent assortment means how one tetrad lines up with respect to blue and red directions is not at all affected by how all the other tetrads are lining up or assorting. Each tetrad flips its own coin and randomly goes red one way, blue the other. All right? And when, so the law of independent assortment refers to what specific part of meiosis? Metaphase one. The law of segregation also has to do with a specific part of meiosis. Well, segregation is another word for separation. To segregate things means to separate them and tell them apart. Law of segregation, as you see, says that the two alleles, so we're talking about a diploid cell, the two alleles for each gene separate during gamete formation. Well, what's the process that forms gametes for a diploid cell? What process forms gametes? What is gamete formation referring to?
Fertilization?
No. No. Meiosis. When a diploid organism needs to make haploid gametes, which need to be haploid, then you use the division technique that reduces the ploidy in half. That's meiosis. So gamete formation here is just another phrase for meiosis. And what the law of segregation says is simply that after they have already assorted, lined up with blue one direction and red the other, they will separate. One allele will go to one cell, the other allele, because it's riding on a different chromosome, will go to the other cell. They don't both go to the same cell. All right. So what specifically is law of segregation talking about? What specific part? Yes.
Anaphase
1. Anaphase 1 is when the two alleles, because they're on separate chromosomes of the same type, are going to separate from each other and go into separate cells. Right? That happens in anaphase. Okay, the law of independent assortment says how each tetrad lines up, blue, which direction gets blue, is independent for each tetrad. This one happened to be that both reds are on the same side. This one happened to be that each of the two cells is going to get a red and a blue. A red of one chromosome and a blue of the other chromosome. Okay, that's one of the reasons why sex has so much additional variation, because there's multiple ways for this to happen. And therefore, unlike the parentals, which had only one kind of gamete, these F1s can each produce multiple different kinds of gametes because they're heterozygous to begin with. So it does matter which chromosome you pick, right? A double heterozygous is going to have two different Ys and two different Rs. So it does depend on which Y you pick and which R you pick. That's why there are four possible gametes that an F1 can make and four different gametes that another F1 can make when you cross two F1s to make the F2. So random fertilization, which is that third part of additional variation that sex provides, that refers to the fact that you're randomly choosing one of the possible gametes from one and one of the possible gametes from the other and getting them together. Well, there's 16 ways you can do that, right? 4 times 4, because there's 4 ways you can choose from this parent. For each of those 4, there's 4 ways you can choose from this parent. That's why you have a ratio in the F2 that adds up to 16. It's 9 to 3 to 3 to 1. 9 plus 3 plus 3 plus 1 is 16 combinations. All right? And 9 sixteenths of the offspring are going to expected to be double dominant. Dominant color, dominant texture. 3 of them will be dominant recessive, dominant texture, recessive color. 3 will be recessive dominant, recessive texture, dominant color. And 1 sixteenth will be double recessive, green and wrinkled. All clear? Well, it needs to be within a week. Let's go on to slide 2. Talk about fruit flies for a little bit. Fruit flies are used a lot in genetic experiments for various reasons, including the fact that they're very easy to keep alive in the lab. So, you know, you don't want your subjects dying in the middle of the experiment or it affects your statistics. But also, importantly, a generation is only about a week. So in a year's worth of research, you can go through 50 generations, which is a lot. But anyway, what we care about is just the fact that they are a good example of something I want to talk about in this chapter, involving, in this case, a characteristic that is eye color. That's why their eyes are shown in such detail here. Well, there's really all kinds of different colors that can result in natural fruit flies. But in this population that we're studying, there's these two possibilities. This reddish one and white. Now, the red is an example of wild type. You can use the phrase wild type for either a characteristic, for a trait, or for an allele. Remember that traits correspond to alleles. So keep in mind what I said wild type means. Wild type only means the type, either of allele or trait, that you see most often in nature, in the natural population. Now, that does not say anything about dominance notice. It just means it's what most individuals have, or what more individuals have than any other. But often it is the case that the wild type is also dominant. It just doesn't have to be. Wild type simply means the plurality. In this case, though, the wild type red eye is also dominant over the mutant type, which is white. So given that background, let's go on to 3 and look at a cross. Now, I just want you to look only at the P generation row that's listed there. What is different about this cross compared to all of the crosses we've looked at so far? This one, P generation. Yes, this is the first time that we cared at all about male or female. So this is the female symbol, this is the male symbol. Well, we didn't care about that on any of the previous crosses. For instance, the first one we looked at was the P flower color, right? Purple and white. we didn't pay attention to which one was the mother and which one was the father, right? Which was the male, which was the female. Because it doesn't at all matter. All we knew was that one of the parents was true breeding purple, one was true breeding white flowered. Well, it could be the female is purple, the male's white, or the male's purple and the female's white. If you do it either way, you'll have exactly the same results with respect to the famous ratios in the F2, F1 and F2. Okay? The reason that it doesn't matter which one's male or which one's female is that that particular characteristic, which is governed by the corresponding gene, the flower color gene, that gene is autosomal. And so have all the other examples besides this. They've all been autosomal. What is an autosome? What did you already learn is an autosome? It's what? Well, I appreciate you trying to guess based on the linguistics. Some means body. Just as it means body in the word chromosome, which means colored body, because they look colored when you look at karyotypes. Okay, but think back to when I showed you that karyotype. That's when I told you what an autosome is. An autosome is any chromosome other than a sex chromosome. So for the human example that we looked at, there were 23 kinds of chromosomes, right? Numbered 1 and onward. Well, 1 through 22 are autosomes. And then that 23rd pair is a pair of sex chromosomes. The reason we make a distinction between the two is that autosomes come in truly homologous pairs. What I mean by truly homologous is that they are the same size, they have the same number of chromosomes, the two number ones, for instance, and the two number 22s, and everything in between. Those are autosomes. Well, if you are considering in your experiment your one characteristic that you're considering, like flower color, for instance, if that happens to be governed by a characteristic that is on any autosome, then both males and females have two of them, right? And therefore, it doesn't matter whether you're male or female. But sex chromosomes are not truly homologous. They're not the same size. They don't have the same number of genes. For instance, in humans, which is also true for fruit flies, coincidentally, the X chromosome is bigger than the Y chromosome. So there are a lot of genes for which is an allele on the X chromosome, but nothing on the Y. Okay? And therefore, if we're considering a characteristic that's governed by a gene that is on a sex chromosome, we call that a sex-linked characteristic or a sex-linked gene. Now, sex-linked as a phrase means just what I told you, that the gene occurs on a sex chromosome. All other characteristics are autosomal characteristics, and all other genes, therefore. So there are autosomal genes, there are sex-linked genes. Okay? Now let's look at this specific cross. It's going to look like it's not really any different from what we've looked at from the beginning, with the purple and white flowers. You have two parents. They differ in their traits, right? One is red-eyed and one is white-eyed. But here we are paying attention to the sex. It's the female that is red-eyed. She's the dominant phenotype. The male that's white-eyed. If you cross them to make the F1 generation, it looks like it's the same thing as the flowers. Because 100% of the F1 generation have the dominant phenotype. They're all red-eyed. That's deceiving, though. It looks like it's the same, but a different thing is happening. When you then cross F1 with F1 to produce the F2 generation, it yet again looks like it's the same familiar 3-to-1 ratio. Right? Because overall, this is assuming however many offspring are produced, about half of them will be males and half will be females, which usually happens. Overall, therefore, if that's true, half males and half females, overall, 3/4 of them will be red-eyed and 1/4 will be white-eyed. That seems to agree with the normal Mendelian situation. But it's not the same, because look at the sexes. In the F2 generation, 100% of the females are red-eyed. Half of the males are red-eyed and half are white-eyed. So there are no white-eyed females produced. All right? That's different from the 3-to-1 ratio of purple flower to white flower. It means that 3/4 of the overall population will be purple flowered. Some of them will be male, some of them will be female. And 1/4 of them will be white, both including both males and females. Okay, well, let's look at why sex matters here. Like I said, this characteristic is called a sex-linked characteristic because the gene for fruit fly eye color is on the X chromosome, which is a sex chromosome. So it's a sex-linked characteristic. And by the way, sex chromosomes are called that because they, in one way or another, depending on species, help determine the sex of offspring. And we humans actually use the same system as fruit flies do, the XY system, in which there are two versions of a sex chromosome. There's an X version and a Y version. They're not the same size, as I've said. But what determines your genetic sex is that if you have two X's, you're female. If you have an X and a Y, you're male. Same with fruit flies. But since they're not truly homologous, X and Y, they're the same type of chromosome, so we say they're homologous, but they're not truly homologous because they don't have the same number of genes. That means that a female, which is female because she has two X's, is going to have two alleles for this characteristic, for this gene, right? But a male, by virtue of being XY, that's what makes him male, is only going to have one allele. Because the smaller Y chromosome doesn't even have that position on it. Okay? And therefore, for males, when we're considering a sex-linked characteristic, we don't use the words homozygous or heterozygous to describe males. Neither one of those terms makes any sense for a male, right? Homozygous means both of your alleles are the same. Well, a male doesn't have two alleles because there is none on the X. Heterozygous means you have two different alleles. He doesn't have two alleles, so it doesn't make any sense. Those words make sense for a female because she does have two. But for a male, we use the word hemizygous. And hemi means half. Like in hemisemidemiquaver. That's the name for a 64th note in music.
Oh,
a half of a quaver, yeah. Which a quaver is a quarter note. Anyway, The reason it makes sense to use hemi meaning half is that compared to a female, he has half as many alleles for that gene. He has one, she has two. All right? Now let's look at what's happening with their chromosomes. This is the original P generation, just with chromosomes shown. So it's the same as the top row. She, by definition of her femaleness, has two X's. And not only, by the way, can we see by looking at her eyes that she has the dominant phenotype, but by looking at her chromosomes, we see that she is true breeding. She's homozygous wild type, or homozygous red. Right? Homozygous dominant. By the way, this is yet another standard way of putting the genotypes. Usually we use a letter that indicates the dominant phenotype, right? Here we're using a letter to correspond to the mutant type, which is white. That's what the W stands for. But if you stick a plus superscript on it, it means red instead. So W plus means red. She has two W plus alleles. She's true breeding, red-eyed, homozygous dominant. He, on the other hand, by definition of his maleness, has an X and a Y chromosome. The Y doesn't have any eye color allele on it. It's missing from the Y chromosome. And therefore, he's hemizygous. Well, he happens to have the white allele for his only allele. And by the way, notice that for a hemizygous male, since he has only one allele, dominance is not an issue. Dominance only comes into play if you have two alleles. You have to have one that dominates over the other. Well, he has only one, so whatever version he has for his one, that's what determines his phenotype. It happens to be white in this case. So now, those are the parents. Let's allow them to make gametes via meiosis. Meiosis randomly chooses one or the other chromosome, right? Well, she's true breeding, so it doesn't matter which one of these you choose. That's why she can make only one kind of egg with respect to eye color. And that's why this Punnett square has only one row. If you really wanted to, you could make four boxes, but the second row would be identical to the first. It doesn't matter which one you choose. So this is just a simplified version of the Punnett square. He, on the other hand, can make two different kinds of sperm because meiosis can choose the X or it can choose the Y. Now, when you get together egg and sperm in the Punnett square, not only do you produce zygotes, but since these are sex chromosomes that are being carried or that you're paying attention to, it also is going to tell you the sex of the zygote. Getting this egg together with an X sperm is going to make an XX, a female. And what this says is that every female is going to be heterozygous. And because red is dominant, every female is going to be red-eyed in the F1 generation. It also tells you that every male, which is an XY, is going to be hemizygous red. Red is the only allele, and therefore the eyes are red. So overall it says that 100% of the offspring should be red-eyed. Just like in the flower color one, but it's happening in a different way. Do you see that? Because it's a sex-linked characteristic. All right, well then you cross F1s with F1s. They are not like the original parents. So she, an F1 female, is heterozygous, not homozygous. She therefore can produce two kinds of eggs. It's going to carry an X, definitely, because you're choosing an X, but you can choose a red X or a white X. And every F1 male can produce either a red X or a non-color carrying Y. Right? So this predicts that 100% of the females will be red-eyed in the F2, but half of them will be homozygous, half of them will be heterozygous. That's why two are listed here. They're both red-eyed, but half of these females are true breeding, half of them are heterozygous. The males, you expect to be half red and half white, which is exactly what we got. So it's not really that it's a 3-to-1 ratio. Sex matters. There are no white-eyed females. Any questions on all of that slide?
Well, basically, I think that, like, I don't know. I don't want to do something. Maybe I just need to go home and review it myself, because the whole thing to me is confusing. Because, like, this, it was like a sex-linked chromosome. Like, how do we, first of all, the trait, the characteristic, if it's sex-linked, and like in the first place, how would we know?
Well, you wouldn't. Like this would have confused the hell out of Mendel. Just like it would have confused him if there had been more than two possible traits for a characteristic that he chose. Because that would have resulted in these exceptions to Mendelian genetics that we went over. Mm-hmm. Now, the exception here is that you're not dealing with an autosome, you're dealing with a sex chromosome. And I, by the way, I want to make it clear that a sex chromosome is called that because it is involved in determining the sex of offspring, but that does not mean that all of the genes that are on a sex chromosome have anything to do with sex. Like, eye color has nothing to do with sex. It's just that a male is only going to have one allele for that, and a female is going to have two, simply because the sex chromosomes are not equal to each other. X and Y are not the same. X has it, and Y doesn't.
I think that then I got confused, because it starts with like a white-eyed male, but so it's possible that he
could have been
the first place in the P generation?
No, we choose the P generation.
Oh.
So this happens to be a white-eyed male because that's what we crossed. But because of the fact that this is, he's not, you know, unlike the white-flowered pea plant, he is not homozygous white, homozygous recessive. He's hemizygous. It only takes one recessive allele to make a male have that recessive phenotype, because there's only one allele involved in a male. It can't be dominated over because there's only one of them, and it happens in this case to be white.
So for example, like, if there was like, I don't know, wing color was on the autosome,
if eye color on the flies were autosomal?
No, so like on this example, it's eye color on the sex chromosome. So
yes.
In the end, the Y doesn't even have an allele, right?
Right. The Y does, that has no.
Is that what, if it was like wing color on an autosome, then it would have two choices respond to the male.
Yes, if it were on an autosome, then it would be just like the flower color example, and maleness and femaleness wouldn't matter at all. And that's because both males and females have two alleles on an autosomal gene, of an autosomal gene, because they're truly homologous. Both versions have the same number and types of genes. But in a sex chromosome pair, an X chromosome has a lot more genes than a Y chromosome has. So in a male, which by definition is an XY, for any of those genes that occur on X and not in Y, he's only going to have one allele. That's what makes the difference. Is that clear it up at all?
Clearer.
Okay.
I think I was slow on it. I probably have to go back and look, because like, I think it's confusing me just to think like if it's not occurring on X, like then it's not there.
It's just missing.
Yeah.
Right? It's. Well, let me show you this next. I think it's the next slide. Yeah. Slide 4 is a photograph. This is using humans, X and Y. You can see that the X is a hell of a lot bigger than the Y. So there's thousands of genes on this X chromosome. Well, most of them are at places for which there is no corresponding place on the Y. So there are some genes that are on both X and Y, very few. Most of the genes that are on X just aren't there at all on the Y. So if you are a male, you have an X and a Y, and what you care about, like the eye color thing, is a gene that is one of these that are on X but not on Y, then a male is only going to have one allele. He's not going to have two, like for any autosomal gene. the two number twos, you know, if you're tracking a characteristic that's governed by a gene that's on number two, an autosome, a male's going to have two, just like a female has two. And that's why maleness and femaleness does not matter in autosomal considerations. But it does for sex chromosomes.
So that together, would you call that a pair?
Yes, and we actually even use the word homologous. Okay. Even though they're not truly homologous because they're not the same size, they don't have the same number of genes. But they do come together still. They still synapse during gamete formation. Because, you know, this is why a sperm is going to get either a Y or an X, because they still form a tetrad, and each of the two cells that results from meiosis one is going to get one or the other, not both, or not neither. No, because Y is kind of like a small, just a part of X. This part they have in common. This part is just missing from the Y.
Okay.
And any gene that's in that missing part is going to be only on X, and the female will have two of them, and a male will have only one of them.
That actually makes sense. I don't know why. As soon as you're like... Okay.
Okay, good. The photograph helps then.
Makes sense. Yeah.
And in the other picture, the Y was...
Yeah, I wish they hadn't done that. I don't, yeah.
Yeah, I
don't. It does make it more confusing to understand. All right, well, let's go on to five and talk about just some, definitely not all, of the sex determination mechanisms that animals use. Now, first of all, this is not at all an exhaustive list for even animals, but also, of course, animals are not the only sexual species. But this just shows you that how sex is determined can differ quite a bit from type of organism to type of organism. We are examples of organisms that use the XY system, which is what fruit flies used in the previous example. It's named, of course, for the two versions of the sex chromosome. X and Y are both sex chromosomes, but they're not the same as each other. One of them is called X and one of them is called Y, though that's why the system is called that. Now look at the genotypes of the male and female humans. 44 plus XY or 44 plus XX. What's the 44 mean?
The autosomal.
Right, there are 22 autosomes in humans. 23 overall chromosomes. 22 autosomes plus a sex chromosome. But humans are diploid, so there's two of each of those. There's two of each of the 22 autosomes, that's 44 total chromosomes, plus an X and plus a Y for a male, or plus an X and plus another X for a female. Okay? So what genetically determines femaleness is having two X's. Genetic male is XY. And you've probably all heard that the father, for humans, the father determines the sex of the offspring. Have you heard this?
Mm-hmm.
The mother doesn't determine it because, like we just saw for flies, she is an XX by definition. And so, doesn't matter which one you choose, the egg is going to contain an X. Right? So all she can donate as a sex chromosome to her child is an X. The male, on the other hand, is XY. So meiosis can choose the X for a sperm or the Y for a sperm. He can make two different kinds of sperm. And therefore, he's going to add to her X either an X to make a female daughter or a Y to make a male son. Well, that's kind of the goal of education. It's what you paid for.
The X and the Y is what part of
you have? No, actually, it's a lot more complicated than that. I can't get too deeply into it in this. We're going to run out of time. But that's just part of what sex ends up being. There's a chromosomal basis for it. And that's why I say it's a genetic male or a genetic female. because the chromosome versions you have is just part of it. We all actually start out unisex, neither male nor female. And then depending on how the hormones, which hormones get released at which time and in which abundance, we develop either male parts, female parts, or both. So there, you know, it's societally we have kind of artificially created this duality of gender when really it's a continuum. There's very male males, there's very female males, females, and there's things in between as well. There's not just two possibilities for gender. Not only societally, but physiologically and anatomically. Okay, so that's us and a lot of other kinds of animals as well. The grasshopper exemplifies the so-called X0 system, which most people would say XO, but I say it's a zero because it really stands for nothing. There isn't an O type of chromosome. There's an X type only in this species. And what makes a grasshopper female is that she'll have two X chromosomes. A male will have only one X chromosome. So it's X plus nothing else. That's why it's the X0 for a male. Okay, only one kind of chromosome. How many you have of that sex chromosome determines your sex. Chickens are next as an example. This is the so-called ZW system. Obviously, they don't use X and Y chromosomes. They're called Z and W chromosomes. But other than that, it works almost exactly like the XY system, except in reverse with respect to which sex has the mixture. For humans, it's the males have the two, XY, right? And the females have the same, two of the same. Well, it's the reverse for chickens. ZW makes you female, having one of each type. ZZ makes you male. And therefore, the one that determines the sex of the offspring is reversed. It's female chickens that determine the sex of the offspring, because her egg can be either a Z version or a W version. His sperm has to be a Z version. All right, and then finally on the bottom we have the haplodiploid system, which is seen in several social insects, including bees that we see here. This is the one that I find the most interesting simply because it seems bizarre from our point of view. Of course, perfectly normal for bees. But the reason it's called the haplodiploid system is because ploidy matters, and there aren't any sex chromosomes. There are only autosomes in these bees. Namely, for this specific species, there's 16 autosome types. N is 16. If you have two of each of those, in other words, if you're diploid, that makes you female. If you're haploid, you have only one of each of those 16, that makes you male. Now, the reason this can happen, totally different from us, is that a female's eggs do not have to be fertilized in order to develop into offspring, multicellular offspring. You know, for a human, and for almost all animals, if an egg goes unfertilized, it won't live very long. It'll just die as an egg. Right? Doesn't turn into the next generation of multicellular individuals. But a bee, a female bee, her eggs can develop into multicellular offspring without being fertilized. They can also, though, develop if they're fertilized, which will produce a zygote as usual. In other words, a female bee, if she chooses to mate and therefore receive sperm that will fertilize her eggs, that'll produce zygotes, which by definition are diploid. And therefore, that makes all of those offspring female. She can have daughters by mating. Or she can choose not to mate, lay eggs, unfertilized, that develop into haploid males. She can have sons by not mating.
Now, are there so much male and female?
Yes, exactly. That's right. And so that's quite different from how we do things just on its own. But also there's a couple interesting ramifications of that. A male, by definition, is haploid, right? That's what makes him male. Well, a male bee does not have a father, that means. Right? Because if he had a father, then a father and a mother would have gotten their gametes together to form a diploid offspring, which would not be a male. It would have been a female. So no male has a father, and similarly, no male can have a son. Because if a male mates with a female bee, that's going to produce a diploid zygote, which is going to, by definition, be female. He can only make daughters. Despite that, though, a male does have a grandfather. Because his mother, being diploid, came from a father and a mother. And similarly, a male can have a grandson, even though he can't have a son. Because his daughter can make males just by laying eggs that aren't fertilized. So it's perfectly normal for them, but quite different from how we work things.
Are those haploid sons, like, genetically identical?
Well, they can't be genetically identical to the queen because the queen is diploid. No haploid is genetically identical to a diploid. But also, they don't have to be genetically identical because remember that she's diploid, and therefore she can produce different kinds of eggs depending on which chromosome gets chosen. And since she has many types of chromosomes, there's actually millions of different kinds of eggs she can produce that are genetically different. They'll all be males if none of them gets fertilized, but they don't have to be genetically identical. You see that? Okay. Let's go on to 6. What am I doing on time here? Okay. In 6, we're looking at just a few possible matings between humans when considering a genetic disorder. Now, genetic disorders is a broad category. For instance, cancer, as I said, is a genetic disorder. But a genetic simply means involving genes somehow. In cancer, genes get damaged. So cancer is genetic, but it's not heritable. Some genetic disorders are heritable disorders, meaning you get them because of the version of allele you get from a parent passed on. And a heritable genetic disorder could be caused by either a dominant allele or a recessive allele. Usually the version that causes the disorder is recessive, but it doesn't have to be. In this case, it is. And also, even more specifically, this one happens to be an X-linked characteristic, a sex-linked characteristic. So it's not only heritable and recessive, but it's on the X chromosome. And so these are not the only possible matings, but there's 3 examples showing you different outcomes for their offspring. The white background for this female indicates that she's totally normal. Not only does she not have the disorder, but she's also not a carrier. You can see that in her genotype. First of all, it's she because it's XX. The N superscript tells you which version of the allele for this characteristic, the disorder, she has. She has both normal versions, which are the dominant ones. He, the father, is dark red here because he has the disorder. So he's affected. If they mate, then the Punnett square says 100% of their daughters, if they have daughters, will be carriers. None of their daughters will have the disorder. That's what the light red means. But they're called carriers because they have a mutant allele that they can pass on to their offspring and therefore maybe cause their children to have the disorder, but they don't have it themselves. And the same Punnett Square says that these two parents will, if any boys that they have, will be totally normal. And that's because to be a boy, you have to get a Y. Well, that has to come from the father. That doesn't contain the allele. The X has to come from the mother, when in this case she was totally normal. The middle example is a little bit chancier with respect to producing offspring with the disorder. This is a carrier female and a totally normal male crossed. Here you have, once again, no affected daughters, but half of them will be carriers, half of them will be normal. In this case, though, half of the boys will be normal and half of them will have the disorder. Remember, there's no carrier, or I shouldn't say remember because I haven't said this, but there are no carrier males, right? Because this is a sex-linked disorder. You either have the disorder or you don't because of your one allele that you have. And then the chanciest one is if you have a carrier female and an affected male. In that case, half of your daughters will be carriers, half will have it, none will be normal. Half your boys will be normal and half will be affected. Yeah.
This actually would just go back to everything. So in a Punnett square, at the end, the zygote, is it just going to be, are those just all the possibilities for just one?
Yes, that's what any Punnett square is. I'm glad you asked this. A Punnett square is an exhaustive list. It's every possible zygote that these two particular parents can have. When all you care about is that one characteristic. Of course, they can have trillions and trillions of different kinds of zygotes, but we don't care about anything other than this one characteristic. And for this one characteristic, these two parents can have these four possible zygotes. And that's every Punnett square. It gives you an exhaustive listing. Because it's every possible gamete matched up with every possible gamete from the other parent.
It's not like they're really going to have
no.
Like, oh.
No. It means if they have one child, it's 50% chance that it's male, 50% chance that it's female. If it is male, these two, it's going to be normal. If it's female, it's going to be normal phenotypically, but it's going to be a carrier. All right, 7 will be the last slide I talk about today. This cat example is just one way in which species have evolved ways to achieve what's called dosage compensation. And so let me define that term. Dosage compensation only is a problem when we're considering sex-linked characteristics, sex-linked genes, which in this fur color example is true. If it's an autosomal gene, then the dosage, the so-called dosage, is equal for the two sexes. The dosage here refers to how many alleles you have for that characteristic. All right? And for an autosomal example, males and females have equal doses. If it's a diploid species, they both have two alleles for whatever autosomal characteristic. Does that all make sense based on definitions?
What was dosage?
Dosage is how many alleles an individual has. But for a sex-linked characteristic, a female has a double dose. She has two alleles compared to a male. It's called a dose because each individual allele can be transcribed, right? And then those mRNAs can be translated into proteins, right? So if you have two alleles, you can transcribe at twice the rate compared to one that has just one allele. You can end up making more proteins in a given amount of time compared to a male, if you're a female, if you have a double dose. Well, that can cause various kinds of complications, which is why species have evolved ways to compensate for that dosage inequality. And that's what's called dosage compensation. Now, if you think about it, there's two ways to go about solving this. One way, which is not what's shown here, is to bring the male up to the level of the female. He only has one dose, she has two, right? He has half the dose. And so if you could make the male gene much easier to transcribe, then it might be transcribed twice as easily as a female version, and therefore his one allele would roughly be enough to equal her two alleles. All right, that's bringing the male up to the level of the female. Or you could bring the female down to the level of the male. And that's what is shown in this example with the cats. When that is done, or one way of accomplishing that is called X chromosome inactivation, which does exactly what the phrase tells you it does. It inactivates an X chromosome in a female. Right, so by definition of sex chromosomes, a female has two X chromosomes. She's XX. And you can make her equal in dosage to a male if you simply inactivate one of those X chromosomes. Then she's only going to have one allele that works, just like a male does. Inactivation of an X chromosome is accomplished by so tightly coiling up that chromosome, even beyond what it is when we look at it at metaphase, that you can't access any of the genes. So the chromosome is still there. It's just not going to work. None of it can be transcribed, so it might as well not be there. And it's permanent, meaning for the lifetime of that individual. All right? Now, if you consider a homozygous female, then X chromosome inactivation doesn't matter with respect to which chromosome of the two gets inactivated, right? Because a homozygous female has two of the same allele, one on each of the two chromosomes. So if you just randomly choose one of the chromosomes, doesn't matter. The other one's going to be just like it. So for this fur example, there's two possible alleles, yellow fur and black fur. Well, a homozygous female would be either orange or black. Every cell has two oranges for an orange female, and therefore turning one of them off is still going to give you orange. Converse for black. But for a heterozygous female, it does matter which one gets inactivated, right? Because the phenotype that she's going to have is the one that does not get inactivated, corresponds to the one that doesn't get inactivated. Okay, well, that's when you have a situation like this where you have patchiness of color. The reason this happens is because the inactivation of one of the X chromosomes does not happen at the zygote stage. Remember, you start out as a single zygote cell. If it did happen at the zygote stage, you'd flip a coin and inactivate one X chromosome or the other. If you inactivate black in a heterozygous zygote, then orange would be activated, and therefore all of the cells that zygote eventually becomes would have the orange activated and the black inactivated. It would be a fully orange-haired cat. Similarly, for if you turn off the orange, it'll be black. But that's not when it happens. It's after the zygote stage, in the embryonic stage, when it's already multicellular. And every individual cell randomly turns off either the one X or the other. Okay? Once it is inactivated, then all the cells that arise from that cell splitting will have the same X chromosome inactivated in them. So if you consider this multicellular lump of cells, the embryo, that will be eventually a cat, it's multiple cells, though. Each one individually flips a coin and turns off either black or orange. But the position of that cell in this mass that we call the embryo matters, because when that cell, wherever it is, divides, it's going to eventually make millions and millions of cells in that area of the cat. And they'll all be either orange or black, depending on what the coin flip was for that one original cell. And that's why next door to it, another cell might have chosen the other way, and in the adult cat, the very next patch might be a different color. You see what I'm saying there? And so it's not either orange or black. It's black in some spots, orange in other spots, randomly. And there's no pattern to it. We call her a mosaic because of that. And that's pretty easy to detect just by looking at her. Well, there's a human example. You can't really tell this by just looking at a female, but a female can be a mosaic, if she's heterozygous, with respect to the ability to freely sweat. Can't really tell it just by looking at her like fur, but if you got down there and microscopically examined individual pores, some of them would be free sweating and others not, right next to them. She's a patchwork, with respect to the ability to freely sweat. So I'll stop there and we'll enjoy the practicum.